Welcome to the Bicast, a podcast for the bisexual community. December 1st is World AIDS Day. We have with us William Burleson, who wears many hats, and we welcome you to our show today. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you, Annette. Really excited to be here, and thank you too, John.
Oh, awesome. So let's hear a little bit about you and your work and what you are all about.
Oh, sure. I'm a writer by passion in many ways. My day job is in communications, but the rest of my real life is spent as a writer. I did a lot of nonfiction writing in the late 90s and halfway into the 2000s, including writing for like Lavender Magazine, our local LGBT rag and bar rag in town here, and I'm from Minneapolis. And I wrote a column. I had a couple different columns for that over time. And then in 2005, I published my book Bi America, which was something of a cultural anthropology of the bisexual community. And that was a wonderful experience, and it gave me a chance to travel to a lot of college campuses and speak at a lot of conferences and various places and really talk through this topic a lot, which I think is endlessly fascinating. Since then, since I had so much fun writing nonfiction, and I was published lots of other places too, like the Journal of Bisexuality, and this, but I had such great fun with nonfiction, I said, I'm going to write fiction because everybody's going to want to read my fiction. So that really wasn't true, but I have enjoyed the heck out of writing fiction. And I actually am getting a good deal of traction now on writing some short stories. Most recently, having a short story appear in Recognize, an anthology of bi men's writing put out by the Bisexual Resource Center in Boston. That's been a really exciting project.
We are big fans of that book for sure. And we are going to invite you back to talk about all of your books, specifically about your books, because I'm pretty excited about them. So please come back for that. You've also done many things. You worked for the Minnesota Department of Health, and you worked with Rural AIDS Project.
Yeah.
And the Red Door Clinic and the Philanthrofund Foundation.
Yeah, I was a volunteer on the board of, I was a chair of grants and programming on the board of directors as a volunteer for the foundation. It's a great example of how things work in many ways for our community, in that here's a board of directors in a LGBT foundation that some people might look at and go, oh, well, it's a gay organization. It's a gay granting or a gay foundation. Well, nearly half the board of directors was bisexual.
In
fact,
really?
My committee, out of pure coincidence, it never even occurred to me. At one point, I looked around and said, wait a minute, everybody here is bisexual. I don't even know how it happened. It just kind of happened. It was organic. But that's our community, right? That's the LGBT community, where we kind of think our society thinks everything is this. And in fact, it's so much more diverse than that.
It's so internal. I saw this meme one time. It was this fellow that said, I'm not gay, but my boyfriend is, this fellow standing there. And a fellow bisexual goes like, I don't understand. He's not gay. And I'm going like, he's bisexual. Oh, yeah, duh.
Yeah, when people would talk about gay marriage, I would say that a lot of people in gay marriages aren't gay. And I would get like blank stares back.
Yeah, this is our life, isn't it?
Yeah, it's always education, right?
Yeah.
Sometimes you have to grit your teeth to educate.
Yes, grit your teeth and go on. Your story in Recognize, I just read it, is very moving and very telling of how life is for bisexual men, both closeted and not closeted, and making connections with them is very difficult. And did that happen at the Red Door Clinic or?
Yeah, that was people ask oftentimes how much of a writer, they ask any writer, but they certainly ask me how much of it is true. And of course it's like, it's all true. I don't know. I'm not saying it's nonfiction, but really it's true. It's a very typical experience. Like I would have had it testing people for HIV. Although I do, I think I was better than that counselor. I like to make believe I was anyway. But the then you'll know, mm-hmm. and you know what I mean if you read the story. But hopefully I was better at it than that. But that said, it is a very typical experience. I was there talking to people who had never ever in their life ever said out loud that they were attracted to people of the same gender. It's just never come out of their mouth, especially men, mostly men we talked to, because I was in a men's program, but also women as well. But yeah, that was a very common experience, was to talk to people who were so deeply closeted. And oftentimes they were bi men. And that's not part of being bi. That's just the reality of what was their world that they saw outside of themselves. They knew they were attracted to women. Maybe they were married and they were attracted to their wives. They had sex with their wives. They were happy with their wives. They had great, you know, everything was great. But they had this mm-hmm. other part too, and they didn't know what to do with it, and they didn't understand how that could possibly fit into their lives. That discussion, that story, that scenario happened all day long. That was an all-day experience. We used to have a married men's group, for example, and that's exactly what we met for. So we would have a room full of 10 to 20 men would be talking about these very issues, things that they've never talked about to anybody, trying to figure out what on earth does this mean? I am clearly not straight, but I'm attracted to women. How could that be? And then they're like, hi, I'm bi. And then here so in some ways I was a pretty good candidate to run that group. But yeah, that very common experiences, a lot of men getting HIV tests, again, largely men because it's a men's program, but a lot of men getting HIV tests who really had no way to talk about this, and trying to connect them up into some sort of support, some sort of community, connect them to their communities was so critical to try to make this a whole part of their lives and not some secret thing.
Yes. Yeah, John has quite a bit of experience working with the married men community, and I have my own story about that, which I'm contemplating telling, because it gives a view from someone who was affected by a closeted bisexual man, deeply affected by it, and what that hidden closet self-loathing did to his family and himself. Mm-hmm. So I'm thinking on that, but yes, yeah. I understand.
Yeah, I you know, it was funny because our last center by round table, it was very small, but one of the men that came, it was one of the men who had been part of GAMA, which is the National Gay Married Men's Association. And, you know, he was saying that, like, one of the things that brought him to our community was the fact that there are all these men in this group who deny the fact that they were ever attracted to their wives. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and he almost felt, you know, he said there were times where he felt uncomfortable in the group really talking about, like, being in a long-term relationship with a woman and also being attracted to men and being bisexual and not having these guys who also had women in their lives for, in a lot of cases, many years, not grossing out about it. You know, one of the things I always think about, and especially D.C., because, you know, D.C. is a gay mecca. And has been for, like, ever. And, you know, it's like one of the gay meccas that people don't see on the map, but it's here. And it's very much a bourgeois white gay male mecca. Generally, it's not only, but that's, you know, that's a big part of it. And, you know, I tell people, like, when you came to this community back in the ghetto days, there was a gay softball league. There was a gay bowling league. There was a gay chorus group. There was a gay football league. There was this community. If you identified as a gay man, we had dinners. We have, like, potlucks and, you know, events once in a while in the bisexual community. And so for somebody coming out, and especially coming out through marriage, there isn't the kind of support in our community as there is among the gay community. And so
but there isn't even the proper language. I mean,
that's part of it. And, you know, the small G gay and the large G gay are two different words, you know? Mm-hmm. And after Stonewall, it was like everybody was gay. If you were trans gender or bisexual or a lesbian for about 3 months in 1969, you were okay.
Yeah.
And then it all kind of splintered.
Yeah.
For good reason it splintered too, is because it was always a loose coalition. It was a coalition of need. It was shared missions towards simply not getting beaten up or arrested. Those give pretty clear direction about needing to work together in a really meaningful way, and whatever the terminology was almost irrelevant. But whether or not, but needing to really be banded together, our success as an LGBT movement towards acceptance has meant that we can now start talking about the individual things that make us different, or start talking about the real diversity of the community, or some of the unfinished business within the community. And that's just our success. That's a fabulous moment. Thank goodness,
yeah.
Right?
You know, that yeah, we, thank I goodness. Mean,
Yeah. So I mean, it's always been a loose coalition of the LGBT sandwich, and if it tumbles apart a little bit, if we start tumbling our LGBT sandwich apart a little bit, that's probably just a sign of our success.
I think so. I think that's part of the things that happens is you have to kind of go through that process and to get to the goal.
I don't know. I mean, like, I feel like I've spent the last 15 years supporting things that I'm really not my issues, and I want to get back to my issues a little bit, you know. And yeah. You know, I don't personally believe in marriage, but like I support marriage, and I like did all that work, and you know, I want to get something back for it.
Yeah.
You know, and the other thing is like, and let's just talk about marriage for an instant. This is World AIDS Day, so we should be talking about AIDS. But anyway, you know, what gets me is I'm on Facebook and I'm looking at all these beautiful couples getting married, and they're, you know, I'm really happy for them, but so many of them are upscale white people. Mm-hmm. And we know the very fact of the LGBT community is that only a part of the community. I would love to see some mixed race couples, some black couples, some Latino couples, some Asian couples, some, you know, some non-classically beautiful people in some of these pictures to show our diversity a little bit.
And you mean regular people?
Regular people, right, who are also LGBT. And the other thing is that one of the ways that works against our entire community is when that is the model, people don't understand that we come from all over the place.
Yeah.
So it's so easy to turn it into a class thing. And, you know, and in various times, I remember reading about the fight for marriage in Massachusetts, one of the early states, and how the Gay Inc. who were running it really just saw the black community, especially, as kind of an afterthought to kind of bring them into the coalition without any real work going into it. And how, you know, people were like, hey, talk to us before you just like say we're supporters, because we have a whole bucket full of issues that aren't marriage.
That's so true. I think it's really interesting too. We did a needs assessment here in the Twin Cities about a year ago on bisexual needs assessment. It was the third one done about 10 years apart, each one of them. And it was a very fascinating process. And I spearheaded this thing. We did groups, we did surveys, but a lot of focus group, a lot of key informant sort of groups. And it was a couple of big findings about this. And this will actually make sense to what you're saying, reinforce what you're saying in a second. But one of the big findings was how little things have changed for the bi community in the last 20 years. It really wasn't like radical sea change that happened. All the complaints that were in the same document, that needs assessment 20 years ago, were only louder in this new document. It only came out even more loudly, more emphasis. And so that's disturbing. The other thing was, what is that balance? And it was, but there was this shift was largely what is the same answer as was 20 years ago. But the biggest shift took place in more and more people starting to seek an authentic bi community of our own. And that became loud and clear, much more so than 20 years ago. That might be investigator bias. Absolutely. the investigator is me on this one. A year ago, 20 years ago, it was somebody else who had a very limited survey sample. But who knows? But I think that's pretty authentic. And what I'm kind of getting at, and I'm going to tie this up for you, is there's a huge vein of bi-activism that said there's almost conflicting veins of bi-activism. One says that we need a bi community of our own, and then there's the other one says we're part of a greater we want to be part of your community. Hey, gays and lesbians, arm in arm with you guys. Okay. Now they're not actually in conflict, but they, you know, in some ways they're two different things. But my big question is that I got to ask is that how many years do we got to beg for a place at the table before we build our own community? Okay. That's what I get from this. It's like, how many times can we say, hey, you know, 20 years now of saying, hey, yeah, we're here too, and not really being acknowledged. At what point do we say, you know what, the needs of gays and lesbians, which was so in step 40 years ago, 30 years ago, maybe not so much 20 years ago, but maybe now, maybe our needs aren't the same. Maybe we have different issues now. Maybe they've succeeded, whereas we're being left behind. Maybe people of color are being left behind. Maybe the trans community is being left behind. Maybe it's time to start saying, what are our issues, and really focusing on those for a while. And so, you want a bi-separatist? Matt, I don't think so, but they're kind of a bi-separatist sort of way of looking at the world. I just think, and I'm not saying that's the way we need to go. I'm just saying that's the way it seems to be going. Mm-hmm. So it's whether we want it to or not, it's an organic process. This is where things seem to be heading right now.
And we have to agree with you on that.
Mm-hmm. Well, I actually think we do need both. I think we need our own space, and we also need to be part of the larger movement. You know, and through my years of activism, I've been in various places of it. I feel like through the first decade of this millennia, we were disconnected in a certain sense and supportive of especially marriage, but also Employment Non-Discrimination Act bills, trying to make sure that trans people were included in those laws. But a lot of it we did as individuals, uh-huh, and not as part of organization. And so there were the bisexuals within this, you know, in the lobby or writing the letters or knocking on doors or making phone calls. But mm-hmm, we were just seen as allies and not doing this for ourselves. When, you know, when you talk to us, we were like, yeah, well, we're doing marriage because, you know, this is the work, and all the rising tide lifts all boats, and we're about rising the tide. And I think now we're in a different position, and I think the trans community is in a different position because, you know, the two big parts of this agenda that's been, you know, the gay agenda for the last decade and a half is, you know, coming together. Marriage is really just, like I said, it's about a bunch of lawyers at this point, you know, and they don't even need donations because they've got the money to do it. You know, they've got, you know, you need lawyers at the Supreme Court. That's what the marriage movement needs now. And at, you know, at state levels and at district levels or whatever. And, you know, employment non-discrimination is at some level done, at least for federal employees. It's done in a good many states. And as marriage is universal, employment non-discrimination follows in the states. And so, you know, I think like the next step for a lot of those rights are going to be in the courts too. So, you know, what are all the issues that we forgot about? You know, I think HIV AIDS is one of those that the movement has, gay ink movement has tampered for a lot of years. It's been done on the down low. Class and race has been kind of kept on the down low for a long time. I mean, there are groups that do this work, but, you know, like for instance is that, you know, there's not really a broad national LGBT Latino organization that functions like it did even 20 years ago today. Yeah. You know, so I mean, these are things that are missing now, and
right. These
are, you know, and to get the money, to get the grants, to get public support, to get the next stages of issues flowing, you know, they need us.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things one of the things we talked about, like after CBD this year, was the HRC youth report that came out, which showed so many bisexual youth. And we have those connections that other parts of the movement don't have. So we're useful to the broader movement.
So let's focus back on AIDS here, what we're talking about today.
Yeah, let me go.
Thank
I got
you,
my,
John.
Yeah, I got my question.
Yeah, thanks, John.
Good stuff.
So we talked about global HIV AIDS this morning with Lauren Beach. And cool. she's working in Zambia, and she gave a great perspective on Africa and developing world and how AIDS functions there and HIV. And some stats, like the number of HIV positive children and women of childbearing age with HIV, doesn't really connect in the West, because those are things that we actually do pretty well. But other stats do. You know, IV drug users, the percentages who aren't being treated, different standards of care by geography.
Right.
Those are things that are similar. You know, since you've done work in rural areas, you probably could talk about your experience in dealing with HIV AIDS in among rural people.
Absolutely. It is a really interesting. It could not have been a more interesting opening. It's how I started into this work was during doing rural outreach. There is this perception, incredibly incorrect perception, that there are no LGBT people in rural areas. How far from the truth can you possibly be? As we went into Greater Minnesota, working for the Rural AIDS Action Network here in Minnesota, we had a huge number of supporters. Some of whom were families, some of whom were clergy, some of whom were public health, and a lot of whom were LGBT people. The organization was largely services. In other words, we're working with people who had HIV and trying to keep them connected to services. Because one of the things that people have to deal with if they live in the rural areas, and Minnesota is a very large state, with one large metropolitan area that accounts for 3/5 of the state's population, a couple of other smaller urban areas, and then largely farm territory, and so in these areas you could be in fact statistically in the census some of them are called frontier counties because they're so underpopulated. There's so few people. There's just so few people in large chunks of like the northwest of Minnesota, and there's so much poverty in the northern part of northern Minnesota compared to the rest of the state. I mean, not everybody by any stretch, but nonetheless, the economics are there that there's an awful lot of poverty up there. So what we found were an awful lot of people who were LGBT identified who knew no one, who felt very, very isolated. They might know one or two other people in the area. And if you ask them, they say, oh, there's nobody around here. So I remember starting a LGBT or a gay and bi men support group, HIV prevention group, in the basement of a truck stop along a highway in Minnesota. And we would meet at this truck stop. And very quickly, we'd get 20, 25 guys showing up to this weekly. And it was a wonderful group. And they all came in like, wow, I knew like one guy who told me to come to this meeting, but where did all the rest of you come from? And there was so isolated and so disconnected. And that group caught on so fast. It was an incredible activity there. And it was on Tuesday nights and it kind of, it was very secretive. It was in the basement of a truck stop, but, it wasn't that much of a secret. And cause the guys would leave the group, and when the group was over, I believe at like 7:30, they would go up to the bar that was part of this truck stop and have a great time. And I remember at one point, the story came back to me that they're at the bar partying it up, because that's kind of the way these guys rolled. And they were having a good time. And somebody said something to the bartender, what is this, the gay pride parade in here today? And the bartender threw the guy out.
Oh, wow.
What nice sea change that you can have in greater Minnesota that a bartender's throwing out a customer for saying something homophobic.
Because, absolutely.
And that was this experience all over. We went to Unitarian churches. We had an HIV group in a Catholic church. We did all this sort of work in greater Minnesota. The needs were so great, and the access to services was so few and far between. It's an incredible organization, and it continues to grow strong. By the way, that first group I mentioned with the truck stop, they continue to this day. They created it's up in the northern part of Minnesota, or north of Minneapolis on the way to the city of Duluth, about halfway between. And they created a annual pride festival. They call the smallest pride festival in the world, something like that. And they got notoriety for it, especially when protesters showed up. Because actually, when they first did this pride festival, it was really the festival is like 20 guys having a picnic. All right, that's all they wanted to do. They're just having fun. You know, they're just having a good time. So they're going to have this world's smallest pride fair. But that's such nice marketing that it caught fire. And they had protesters show up. So the next year, it's like they're mobbed. People from the cities, you had speakers, you had everybody up there supporting these guys. And the counter-protests were 20 losers in a park somewhere all by themselves. And so just the impact of that kind of stuff. And I bring this up to not just because of the HIV and the support and the LGBT community, but an awful lot of these guys were bisexual. Tons of them. Most of them were, actually. Maybe not most, but an awful lot of them were bisexual. Mm-hmm. And again, to think that they get lost in the narrative that this is a gay rights thing or this is a gay pride parade is really missing the honesty of what was actually happening there. These were guys from all different backgrounds, from all different walks of life, not a ton of them with a ton of money. We had one guy who was a rodeo guy, you know. It's like these are real dudes. And just like every other, no shock to us, but I think to the general population sometimes, it was an awful lot of bi folk and very bi supportive atmosphere.
Yeah,
fantastic.
And a shock to the gay community too, that we exist and that we exist all over and that we are everywhere. And you know, I actually think that makes us a benefit for the LGBT community to show that we're just everywhere. You know, we're not just in the big cities and the ghettos, and you have to deal with us. And to me, that's one of the things that we give to the broader community.
Amen. Absolutely.
Amen. Yeah, I think you kind of just answered my next question because I was just going to ask you: gay, lesbian, men having sex with men, trans women, men, gender queer people, women at risk, IV drug users, all of these populations have different needs and for outreach and respect when doing AIDS education. And you just my question was, how do you reach these groups? And you kind of just told me how you do, because we do, bisexuals do not hang out where everybody else hangs out. I mean, at least they don't say they're bisexual when they do.
it's so true. I mean, it's a funny thing. People used to ask, when I went out to these groups, it's like, well, how do I find those missing bisexuals? Because they knew the statistics that like half the LGBT population is bisexual. Where are they? Because some of these groups, some of the organizations for doing HIV work for the MSM, the Men Who Have Sex With Men communities, they would look around, and lo and behold, everybody in their group was a gay man. It's like, well, look at the leadership of your group. Guess what? Yes. They look like your group, you know, that your group looks like you. You know, that's not a shock. So they say, well, where are they? Why can't I find them? And it's like, well, first you got to notice that they're sitting in front of you most of the time. But second of all, it's like people, these guys, like in that truck stop example, these guys code shifted. They knew to what to call themselves today, that to get by. And if they're going to find that if they needed support from the Minnesota AIDS Project, if they needed support from some mainstream, some other organization, that they could go to that today they're going to call themselves gay, and then tomorrow they're going to call themselves bi, because they got to get by, so to speak. Mm-hmm. You know, they mm-hmm. just got to get by. They got to get the services they need. So I guess my point on that is that it doesn't have to, it shouldn't have to be this hard for these guys. It just shouldn't have to be this hard. It could be much easier, and the wheels much better greased for these guys to get the services that they need that are relevant to them.
Exactly.
So
exactly.
Aim there, and now you're going to find all the people that you need to find. Because I couldn't help but notice that I had that it wasn't hard. I got to say too, and for example, in the African American community in the Twin Cities here, when I was working for the Red Door Clinic doing HIV outreach and testing and such, people used to say, "Wow, why can't we locate African American MSM?" It's like, are you blind? what are you missing here? Can I show you around? Let me help you, because I don't know how you could not find them. But if we don't leave our comfort zone, you know, if you're a white male identified person and you're gay and you're young and you're going to go out and you're going to go try to find somebody that doesn't look like you, you're going to have to leave your comfort zone. Mm-hmm. Right? Because it's not your community that you're going to. You're going to somebody else's community. You need to be respectful, and you have to listen rather than talk. Yes. And you have to do, and it's true with any community. This is across the board. It doesn't matter what you're doing in life, you know, is be respectful and listen more than talk, and find out what people, you know, what's going on in their lives, and not tell them what should be going on in their lives or what is happening. And yeah. And so I don't know. I always puzzled over that one. And sometimes it's like, is maybe they're not comfortable walking in the right bar, you know, or going to the right event. Because when we had a house ball once, for example, and the room's full of young, a lot of transgender, African-American men and transgender, females, that it wasn't that hard. Okay. People just got to try. Maybe I'm starting to get excited about the excuse of I can't find it. It just doesn't work for me any longer.
And then I totally agree. You can find, I mean, I did. And I couldn't have found them last year, but if I could find them this year, I just put forth the effort and joined groups and went and listened to people. Exactly. And found them all over the place.
Exactly.
Well, you know, I mean, I here in D.C., and, you know, it's funny because, you know, 15, 20 years ago, we actually had a pretty strong bisexual community, and, you know, people who were around the gay community who were bi, especially bi men, never found us. And, you know, I mean, oh, we had, you know, we had ads in the Blade every week, in the city paper, you know, and, even, you know, so even among bisexuals who are looking for a community, sometimes they can't find us. And, you know, maybe it's just that we didn't have a big enough marketing budget.
Well, we've got Meetup going for us, and Google's working better for us, so I think that helps. So,
well, and the other thing that, you know, I mean, I, you know, what I do is work in our local LGBT center. And, you know, I think that one of the things that I always recommend to bisexuals who want to get active is to find your local community center and, you know, and don't take no for an answer, because there's gonna, you know, there's gonna be people that aren't gonna want you around. But there's also gonna be people who have been waiting for you to come in the door.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, find those people, and they're your allies, and, you know, put the B in LGBT centers. Because for a lot of people, those are the first resources that they go to when they're looking for something.
Absolutely. You know, just the support of having the word bisexual in the name of any group. I'm so with you on that. If just having that word out there is like this light, it's like this light in the window that someday I can go do that. I may not be comfortable enough to do it now. I may not be in a place where I can do it now. I may not be in a phase of safety where I can do that now. But that light is on in the window that I can go there someday. And John, you mentioned that earlier about that whole idea of having that kind of those having those groups out there so that you can kind so that as a bisexual or any LGBT or anything go out there and say you know, even if I don't access those services now, just that hope that they're out there. And I say that because if sometimes I think that's where a lot of the anger within the bi community is from. And I say that because I think I identify a lot of anger oftentimes in bi activist circles. And because you know what? We deserve to be angry. And we was well earned anger. And some of that anger is directed at I might have been closeted. I'll give you a scenario. I might have been closeted for years. And let me turn to a me statement. For me, for many years, I was closeted in the early 80s and the late 70s. And so I kind of knew this was out there. And there's always this hope that somewhere out there that when the day I decided I was strong enough to do it, I could go find that group and they would support me. I could find my community. Right. That if I mm-hmm. the day I decide I need that community, I can go find them.
Right.
And the harsh reality of for a lot of bisexuals is that's not the case. Mm-hmm. That the day you need that service where you say, OK, I can do this. I'm going to show up at the LGBT center. OK. And you show up and nothing is going on for bisexuals.
Yes.
Right. And I was like, oh, it was a lie. I don't have it out. There isn't anything out here for me. So is there any shock that people are kind of in the closet, out of the closet, or are hiding and continuing on later in life than, you know, average most bisexuals come out later in life than gays and lesbians? It's not a surprise. That's not a personal flaw. That's a system problem, right? Mm-hmm. There's a problem with the system here. People need to find those support services when they need to find those support services.
Yes.
So it's a huge problem, and we need more and more stuff. And Lynette, I'm with you. There are so many more. I'm seeing this reflowering, this renaissance of the bi movement happening right now. I can't believe I'm saying that. It makes me so happy to say this. But I'm seeing a real renaissance after a golden age of the late 70s and a real just an explosion of wonderful activism in the early 90s, and now and then things really kind of getting very, very fallow for a while there, that now it's starting to really build some momentum. And I think a lot of that's technology. It's the meetups. It's the technology to be able to locate each other and have a podcast like this and to be able to hear my issues brought forward is huge.
Mm-hmm. It's huge. And I'm really excited because a lot of the people from the old time are back here and they're back at it. And it's just such a great resource. It's just, yeah. I'm so happy about that.
Well, a lot of people have always been around, you know, in the dark ages, so to say. You know, I mean, like through the years, I mean, before there was this kind of social media that we have today, I mean, we had a Yahoo group for Binet USA, and there was activity, and, you know, in mid 2000s, there was a writers group, and so, you know, those things existed when there wasn't a whole lot of activity going on. I remember in 2007, really from our desk and couches, we got up because there was an exclusive ENDA bill being put before the U.S. government. And, you know, Binet USA was one of those organizations, and we all came out and did work and phoned our congresspeople and senators and lobbied and wrote letters and organized the people around us to fight this, you know, bill that excluded trans people. And, you know, those are the kind of things that were going on when there wasn't the kind of movement that I see we're building today. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it comes around and goes around and comes around.
Well, one of the things is the technology is so fantastic because I knew nothing about the inner workings of podcasting. And I had only guessed it on a show, but I could learn, and I did. And John and I built the show out of just two regular people. And,
that's awesome.
You know, to help build our community and reach those people who weren't being reached. And we're pretty happy with what we've done. So, that kind of shoestring can get things done kind of thing is more available now, and it's great.
Yeah. We're at an interesting tipping point that way. When I look at like philanthropy, when I work with the P Fund Foundation stuff, most bi dollars are being siphoned off into LGBT groups, and for large chunks of the country and the world, that means gay. Right? Mm-hmm. So let's be realistic. And so that's where it's going. And so all these dollars get siphoned off, and they all go off over that way. So what we're going to have to see in the near future is people with access to capital to not just supporting LGBT concerns, and that's great, please support LGBT concerns, but also supporting bi concerns directly. And if we don't do that, these people don't understand that the entire amount of money, but I believe granted to an LGBT or to a bisexual organization, I don't know about last year, but the year before last, I believe was like $3,000 in the United States. Right?
And they wanted details on that.
which is absurd. Which is just crazy making, you know. And so we gotta get out there and sometimes it's a chicken or the egg. When do you get enough capacity to write the big grants? If you don't write the big grants, how do you get the capacity? So there's a chicken or the egg, but other groups get through this and they do it on sheer mission zeal for a while. We got to support our organizations. We have to support BiNet USA. We have to support it. We have to build it into the strongest organization we come. I firmly believe this. We have to support the Bisexual Resource Center. We've got to make that thing as robust as it possibly can. It's critical. The Bi Foundation is doing great research. Our local organization here, which has got an increasing national presence of the Bisexual Organizing Project, is critical, and that we have another 50 bisexual organizing projects is everything. So we got to build. We just got to keep building out from here and not just let the money get siphoned off into LGBT things.
Yeah, I agree with you. And I have that same vision for if I'd like to see that happen all year long, all of the big cities.
Yep.
So everybody has a place to gather and learn and get educated, because it's like – it's a one awesome event, and I'll be there someday.
Thanks. You all look forward to checking out. Well, I've been to all but about three, I think.
You chaired on that for a couple of years, right?
Yeah, I was involved in a number of them. We were involved in it. We had a national or international conference of bisexuality in the Twin Cities as well, and that was an awesome event in 2004, I think, and that was tremendous. These are the kind of things that need dusting off that have kind of gone fallow and they still haven't been dusted off is the international conferences and North American conferences that were taking place. And there's a bi men's conference that used to be an annual event. That was huge. And some of these events, they just haven't really been come back. And right now is keeping the light on. Well, clearly the big one is the one in England, that BiCon, that's awesome, but they have Because, and you also have the one on the East Coast that I can't remember. Transcending Boundaries, I believe it's called.
Transcending Boundaries, which is in November of next year.
Which is awesome. So we just need so many more things like this, so many more resources and opportunities to talk through these things. Most people aren't going to get a chance to travel across country to go to these things. So it's difficult. We need more of them.
We certainly do. And we need more funding to get our people where they need to be and to present at these things. And not just bisexual events.
Yeah, I also think that, you know, on the other side is we do an awful lot of work with very little money.
Yep.
You know, it was like, you know, Faith was in D.C. for, Celebrate Bisexuality Week. And, you know, one of the things he was remarking on is like, you know, how much capacity we have in our human resources in our community and how much actual physical labor we do for really nothing. We would be the star in any of these Gay Inc. organizations because we do so much for nothing. If we were getting paid for it. We'd be able to do more of it.
Yeah. It's one of our goals to try to get to all the events and get them covered so we can get that broadcast out to people what what there is in their community and encourage others to start doing their own stuff.
Yeah.
You know,
that's just locally. The burnout is so tremendous from doing things for free. You're absolutely right. Rio, my God, look at that. You want to add value to your donated money? You give some money to Bob. My God, every dollar that goes out into programming and hardware.
Yeah.
Oh, my goodness gracious.
Definitely.
Overhead? What overhead? Come on. It's all getting out into the field immediately for putting on events and making things happen. So,
yeah.
But at some point in time, paid staff is critical for some of these organizations because that just having the longevity, and you know, we can run a mission zeal personally for a couple of years until you burn out, and then you got to find new people to burn out, and that's not a workable system. But if you can at least get to that place, I had an interesting story. I went to the White House a year and a half ago for LGBT Pride Month, and I met such an interesting group of people there. And a lot of mostly the people at this reception, it was this wonderful event in the White House, this whole floor, second floor of the White House taken up, and Obama spoke and Joe Biden was there and Mrs. Biden, Michelle, unfortunately, who's my hero, was off in Ireland at the time. But they were all there, and I was there with like 300 of my closest friends. And it was a great event, but most of the people there were donors, are people who donated to the Democratic Party. Obviously, you know, that's probably why they're there mostly, and representing organizations and LGBT politicians. So, but I had this conversation in line and several other occasions I thought, what do I want to talk about when I go in there? What would be of interest to some of these folks? And I said, well, I'm here representing part of the bi community through, and the ticket came from Bi-Ness USA and da da da. Oh, really? A bisexual community? That's really, you never really hear from the bisexual community. And I was, you do know that really half of the LGBT community is bisexual, and they would just be astounded, right? But every stat's been like that since the beginning of having stats on this topic. I say, think of all the dollars that are left on the table from organizations for fundraising by ignoring the bisexual community.
Yeah.
Now I woke them up.
Yeah, now I'm paying attention.
But there was a giant aha for some of those fundraisers that maybe that they have to, the HRCs of the world have to pay some attention to the bisexual community, if only in their own self-interest.
Yes, in their own self-preservation.
Exactly.
And I think they might be getting that hint.
Even in their own staff, kind of like the fact that HRC has opened up a little bit and task force, I know the bisexual people on those staffs now.
That's great.
You know, and, it's like they need to be doing some of our work, too, and trying and pushing some of the money our way.
Yeah.
Yeah. I went to the UN site, and in their description, Bill, in their terminology, it says do not use gay or bisexual because those are cultural terms. Use MSN or men having sex with men.
Okay.
But then they had a hashtag that says this, close the gap, gay men and other men having sex with men, which right there they use the word gay men and other men. And I found this kind of disturbing.
Yeah.
You know, pick one platform or the other. And I do understand the logic about the cultural thing.
Yeah.
I still hate that men having sex with men term anyway because it just leaves out a whole bunch of people.
Well, so
as far as I'm concerned.
It's a clinical term. It's an HIV term that doesn't speak to the culture at all and the identities of the people who are there. That's not satisfying at all to use those. And I'm in a communications guy. That's not acceptable. I would not use those terms. I think that's a fail on their part. If they think that MSM is going to do it, maybe they try to find some safety in the medicalization of LGBT issues. But you know what? We got to stop medicalizing LGBT issues. Okay.
Yes. Yes, I agree with you.
Civil rights moment. Okay. Yeah. It's civil rights. It's not medical.
Civil rights moment. There you go. I agree with you, Bill.
Yeah.
And yeah. I do commend them on this whole campaign for Close the Gap because they're trying to pick up all everybody who's being left behind. And I do love that. But this little thing just really, this lack of bisexual language really kind of bothered me a lot.
Who was it recently? Was HRC who made a serious, really step when they started using the term gay and transgender for instead of LGBT.
Oh, I was glad.
No, it was glad.
Yeah, that's right.
And they've been disciplined.
They know better. Glad has always been.
Good. They had training. Yeah, they do know better.
They know better but than they, that. That was a big fail on their part. That's silliness.
But they're being very much nicer now. Yeah. they've had some education and
more
actually
supportive. They're more supportive than that than it's kind of funny how some organizations it's kind of independent of their name so many times. For example, and I think this is very different in other cities, by the way, but locally here, the PFLAG group,
mm-hmm.
PFLAG definitely was welcoming, but PFLAG, the PFLAG group in town here could not have been more bi-friendly.
Yes.
Absolutely. We are allies all the way. Yeah.
Yes. That is consistent everywhere from what I heard.
Yeah, I mean, we just had Debbie Jackson on. She was at the national conference. She's from Kansas City. It was back when the Orioles were playing Kansas City. So during the playoffs, not good for me as a Birds fan, but for her. At that conference, you know, she has a trans daughter, a 7-year-old trans daughter, and like she really pushed to make them not use the initials and not the terminology. But it's always been a very friendly organization, and I've known like bisexual people who work with PFLAGs around the country and trans people who are on boards around the country. And so, you know, I one of these things about like your initials really has to do with what work you're doing versus
right.
What you're saying, right?
It's like I said,
walking the walk and not talk. You know, walking the walk's more important than talking the talk. And like,
absolutely,
you can call yourself, you can call yourself Sage, and really be, have bisexual and trans people in the organization and leadership positions, and you know, that's a name that you got back in the 70s. So it's fine.
PFLAG can keep their name PFLAG as far as I'm concerned because they are so bi-inclusive, you know. And I'm really less concerned, like I said in an article here, promote myself in an article recently, you know, I'm really less concerned about all the alphabet soup. I'm really more concerned about what are you really doing?
Absolutely.
And that's, what's important.
Right. The day that the task force the rest of the letters on was the same day that we had a pretty biphobic piece published. So, you know. Yeah.
From the task force, yes.
Yeah, so.
Talk about people who know better. We were talking about like various where to find communities and such for the bi community. I know in the Twin Cities here, and I bet this is very common, is like, you know, it may not be at the gay bar, so to speak, air quotes around it. It may not be at the gay organizations. It may be at places in the Twin Cities here, the Men's Center, for example. Mm-hmm. And again, I was very involved in the men's community, so this is why I kind of keep hinging on those. But also, you could talk about Chrysalis, if you want to find where the bi women were hanging out. I know told about that recently, but in the past, the Chrysalis Center was had a lot of bi support. So PFLAG, we just mentioned, here's this. I knew many guys who went there for support. They weren't parents of anybody. They were them. And here's a place that they found that was safe to go and be themselves. And so they would go there and be themselves. And that's awesome. So to try to, where do you find a bi community? Well, you have to find them where we are, which may not be necessarily in gay and lesbian organizations all the time. Or it may be, but it may not be. And we may be finding our own spaces. And these are, so I mean, we have such a need for our own spaces that you just see it screamingly loud all the time.
Potlucks.
We need more potlucks.
We're at potlucks.
Yeah, we
still have potlucks. That's my theory, though. I said we need to be doing activities like that, you know, meetups.
Yep.
We have a bi bar. I'm so proud of Cameron. He just keeps that going. He's been doing that for 3 years, you know, and it's a pretty cool thing, you know, and he does meetings.
Yeah.
But it was hard to find him. It was not easy Googling for a local bi group. It was very difficult. Even when I got to my LGBT center page, I still had to, I put in the word bisexual in the search because I couldn't find anything, and Cameron's name came up, so... That's how I got there. It wasn't that easy. So
I mean, Meetup is a place though, and like, you know, our next center buy event is actually the Lights at the Zoo, which is a family event.
Awesome.
Because
we
were feeling we weren't doing enough family events in center buy, so you know, the zoo
that's
lights
awesome.
Is our next thing. So you know.
Alrighty.
You got to cover everybody.
Not to blow my own horn with this story, but it's a true story. Is because of my book Buy America that came out in 2005. I got contacted a couple years later by somebody from Chicago. Now Chicago is an enormous metropolitan area. As you know, it's the third biggest city in the country. Blah blah blah. Millions of people living there. No organized buy community. It's insane. You know, and historically there used to be a really powerful one. So it was like, this is nuts. But there's no organized buy community. So a guy contacted me out of the blue, which happened a lot, and it still happens a lot because of the book. And they contacted me and said, where do you know about Chicago? What's going on in Chicago? I go, I got bad news for you, my friend. Nothing. You got to get something going in Chicago. Why don't you organize something? Why don't you call somebody? Why don't you get something going? They have a great LGBT center on North Halsted. Check it out. Maybe you can put an ad in the paper. Maybe you can get something going, but it's up to you. You know, you're going to have to do something because my God, the need is great up there. And then purely out of a fluke, like a month later, somebody from Chicago contacted me saying, what in the world is going on in Chicago? And I said, hey, I got somebody you need to talk to. So I connected.
If I got the guy for you,
I connected.
I'll tell you.
How easy was that for me? I connected them up, and they since have a really powerful buy organization that meets at the LGBT Center in North Halsted, and it's been going on for years, and it's just a powerful group. Now, that's no credit to me. It's just like one flick of the wrist, but that tells you how much the need is out there.
Yeah, I was going to say that, like, in D.C., I mean, at one point we had had multiple buy organizations, in the early 2000s, they kind of dissipated. At various points, I was part of, you know, trying to form men's groups. There were other men that were trying to form men's groups. There was another women's group that kind of started. It had ebbs and flows. But, you know, it was really in like 2011 where one of the leaders of the women's group really kind of organized all of us together. And it was at Celebrate Bisexuality Day in 2013 that, you know, she connected us all together again. And kind of like since then, we've been working. And that's kind of how it goes, you know. You've got to find people and create from that.
Yeah, that's awesome. That's a great story, yeah.
Yeah.
So we're going on. So let's talk about AIDS in the United States now.
Okay. What I know about it.
So
I know more about HIV and AIDS in truck stops than I do about in the nation.
Yeah.
I just want to talk about that we do have that bisexual chairman, who is coming in for 2015 for the International Lesbian, Gay, Bisexual, Trans, and Intersex Association. So
cool.
I am hopeful that we will get some more inclusive language happening. So
that's awesome.
Yeah. They worked really hard. They really worked really, really hard, and I'm really proud of them to do that. So
the isolation of bisexuals face increases their HIV risk. It simply does. When people aren't able to be intentional and planful about their sexuality, that increases the amount of unsafe sex that they're going to have. This is well proven from the last 25 years of HIV work, that people got to get connected and they have to be able to make their sexuality whole in their lives in order to make good decisions about their own health. Right? Mm-hmm. If I think I'm going to be driving down, I swear to God, never again will I ever do that again. But maybe I'll just drive by the park tonight.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe I'll go to that party, but I won't really do anything, you know. And these kind of behaviors that aren't really nothing wrong with them, just not being planful about it and saying, yeah, okay, but sure, I'm going to go to the party, but I'm going to play safe. I'm going to plan ahead. I'm going to the Walgreens beforehand or whatever, you know. that I'm going to take actions to take care of my own health along the way. Those are the kind of things that fall by the wayside when you're closeted, when your self-esteem is in the toilet. And we see this all day long in HIV work, and anybody who does it will say the same thing. That's the root of so much of this stuff, is being able to feel supported and feeling whole and in charge of oneself.
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. That's exactly it.
That's a great way to put it. And we've heard it lots of other ways, too. we were going over a study some bits ago in a program months and months back about statistics that show that women, the more they're open about their bisexuality, the better health outcomes they have. All kinds of health outcomes, from, mental illness to substance abuse.
Yep.
These are all like, this is why we do the work that we do and tell people it's safe to be out, because we're out.
Yeah.
You've got to do it so that it helps you.
It helps you. It helps your children. Believe me, I know.
Yeah.
And I have a whole story about that, so someday I will share it.
Oh, okay.
So
I have a great story. Well, I remember one thing I used to say in the clinic. I had my little office in the clinic, and I would talk to guys all day long who many times, again, were maybe the first person they ever talked to about their attractions. And I had one stock thing I used to say all the time. People would say, I can't help it, man. I can't help it. I have these needs and I just can't help it. And I would say, what if you could help it? What if you could? Would it be wrong?
Mm-hmm.
Do you think you're doing something wrong? And it'd be like, well, I don't know. Aren't I doing something wrong? And it was the first time they ever had a concept that maybe they weren't doing something wrong.
Right.
Maybe this is good. Maybe they're loving other men. Oh, wow. Maybe that's a good thing.
Yeah, that's exactly. It's changing that focus, because, I know personally a man who was very self-loathing, very closeted, and him and his wife had no language to speak to each other about this. And, he left this mortal coil feeling quite horrible about himself,
Yeah. The married guys have a whole different hurdle to have to cross as far as what does that mean? What does it mean to come out to your wife? Most of the guys in our married men's group, by the way, were out to their wives.
Yeah.
Most of them were. And so, which is probably not anybody's stereotype of what that group would look like, but that was very typical that they were out to their wives. And they had some, and they may have been monogamous, they may not have been monogamous, they may have had an agreement, they may have been a don't ask, don't tell going on. There's all kinds of different things. Everybody had to figure it out for themselves, because there's no models to work from. Mm-hmm. And so they had to kind of puzzle it out. But anybody's stereotype of what these guys would be about is going to be inaccurate. As like, whoa, I'm wringing my hands, I'm cheating on my wife, isn't this wonderful? Yeah, that's nobody.
Yeah, that's nobody. Nobody feels that way.
Nobody feels that way. No, self-loathing was a huge piece of that a lot of times. It's like, just absolute shame and self-loathing. And because of that, self-destructive behaviors lots of
times. Yes, exactly. Yeah. Because you are ashamed and you do want to hide it, and you don't know what to do with it.
Yeah.
You
don't feel like
they're not. Yeah, and it's not just HIV you're risking, right?
No.
Absolutely.
You're dealing with your mental health. You're dealing with substance abuse, all the other issues that
go with it.
When we look at our stats, we're all high up on those awful stats, and there's reasons for it.
Okay.
And until we feel safe and out and comfortable with ourselves and, live our authentic lives, that's what's going to be the issues for it.
Yeah, authentic lives. Okay, look, John, let's get this wrapped up, okay?
Yeah.
Yeah, that was very good, John. That's exactly right. But, let's get this.
So I guess I should say that all the links will be available on the website.
I cut you off, didn't I? I'm cutting John off. Bill, is there anything else you'd like to add at this time? Anything you want to?
Just to say that you guys rock. Lynette, John, you guys, thank you for doing this. Keeping this podcast going is labor of love. Again, if people didn't already hear this earlier, nobody's getting paid. This is sheer mission zeal. And folks, if you're out there, if you're in a place where you're starting to think, maybe this is a community you want to know more about. Maybe you want to start exploring what this means to you and your sexuality. Find your community. You'll never be sorry that you found your community.
Because we rock.
Absolutely, we're cool.
Yeah.
We are so cool.
And then give us the money.
Yeah, that would help too. All right, I want everyone to remember you are not wrong, you are not broken, and you are definitely not alone. You are a human being, and you are bisexual, and be safe. Bye, everybody.
Bye.
Bye.
Anything else you might think you want to add in there?
No, that was awesome. What fun.
Wow, that was great, wasn't it?
Yeah.
We have to have you back.
Yeah, I can't wait to read your book so we can have you back on and talk about that and your other books, too.
Something I want to... I got to wrest control of my book back from the publisher at some point in time, put out a new edition, because it's getting kind of old now. It's 9 years old.
Yeah, type for a new edition. You can start adding in the new flowering of our movement in there. Huh.
Yeah, because at the end it kind of leaves the question: is like, have we peaked out and is going away now?
Yeah, I think we're back.
I was a downer at the end of the thing because it was
pretty grim
when I wrote that book.
It was pretty grim right about that time.
Yeah, 2000. I mean, those days. I remember those days. You know, and you know, I mean, other than online and a few of my friends, that was my bisexual community then.
Yeah.
You know,
even people didn't give up.
Well, it's like in D.C., you know, I mean, a lot of the people I'd work with, I mean, because, you know, this is such a nomadic town, a lot of them moved on. You know, they went to other cities and, you know, that's how the movement ebbs and flows here.
Yeah.
Yeah. All right, guys, I'm going to wrap up. I got a cat at my door and I hope that you haven't been able to hear him.
Well, I really appreciate this. Thank you. It was a great time. I can't wait to hear it tomorrow.
The views expressed on the Bicast do not necessarily represent those of Binet USA or the Bicast crew.